Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Acqua Alta, that is what the Italians called floodwaters, and specifically the floodwaters that are submerging Venice. The historic city experienced the worst flooding in 50 years this month, the second highest water levels ever recorded there. The tragedy is a combination of an ancient sinking city, an inexorably rising sea, and bold engineering solutions bogged down by bureaucracy, corruption, and misplaced ambition. In other words, Venice is an accelerated test case for every world city that is on or near rising water. So this hour on Point, flooding, climate, and saving Venice. And we will begin today with Silvia Poggioli. She joins us from Rome. She is NPR's senior European correspondent, and she's just back from some extended time in Venice. We have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Silvia, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us what you saw when you were in Venice.
Well, I arrived on Sunday just as at the peak of a high tide, not quite didn't quite reach that terror, very, very high that it hit on Tuesday, November 12th, which was the worst flooding in more than 50 years, more than 6 feet above the sea level. But it was very high. I arrived at the station and it was, and my boots were not quite high enough to get through the water. But I was, all the water buses service was suspended because the buses couldn't go under low, the boats couldn't go under low-hanging bridges. And I was lucky to get a water taxi, which is a motorboat. But what really struck me, and this is when really the idea of rising sea levels really hits home, when I got to the pier, the boat was too high for me to climb in. Huh. And he had to go to the water bus pier, which is a bit higher, so that I could climb down. It was simply the boat came where I should be stepping onto the deck was over my waist. It was impossible for me to get in.
Wow. And the extent
that was really shocking to me.
And the extent of the damage then that we can know thus far to the city and its architecture?
Oh, it's impossible yet to calculate. There's both, you know, there's the damage to everyday houses, the damp, the salt corroding the buildings. Then there's, of course, all these artistic monuments. The St. Mark's Basilica, the crypt was underwater for more than 24 hours. And experts have already determined that there's been damage to the mosaics and some of the marble pillars. The danger there is that all this salt water creeping in will corrode the marbles, the wood, everything. You know, the visionaries who built Venice more than 1,500 years ago used materials that could withstand water, that could be easily replaced. But with rising sea levels now, it's getting into the cement, into the marble, into the wood, and it's really the buildings are in danger of crumbling.
Wow. So let's talk for a moment, Silvia, about how both the Venetian and the Italian governments are coping with this disaster in Venice. Last Thursday, Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte spoke with reporters in Venice and he pledged government support for flooding victims. And Prime Minister Conte there saying, with regard to repairing the damage caused by the tide, we will proceed in two phases. In the first phase, we will be able to compensate individuals and traders up to 5,000 euro for individuals and 20,000 euro for businesses. These resources will be released immediately. That's the Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. So, Silvia, what is the Italian government doing right now to help?
Well, This was the emergency decision because certainly the images of Venice underwater, you know, has a huge impact on all Italians. It's a city beloved by everybody. It's so unique. And so, you know, the government had to do something, but it's a stopgap. It's certainly not enough. I mean, then there's going to be all the cultural, the artistic works, the churches. There's 120 churches. At least half of them have been damaged, built. towers, museums. I was the other day at a cultural foundation that had a its library was seriously damaged, and there were all volunteers there. We're trying to salvage books, putting paper towels between the pages, trying to do at least a stop work. So this is all. There's a lot of volunteers. A lot of young people have flocked to Venice to try to help, and not just doing the cultural stuff, helping Venetians get out of their houses if their houses are totally wet, help them move, take to someplace to higher ground. There's been a big outpouring of emotion and help and very positive thinking, I think, certainly among younger people.
Well, so let's hear then on that note, Sylvia, let's hear what the Venetian mayor, Luigi Brugnaro, said in a video statement last week. He asked for help and cooperation in addressing the city's flooding. And that's the Venetian mayor. He's saying, quote, "We are really risking not being able to manage this anymore. Tomorrow we will ask for a state of disaster in the city. We are asking for help because there will be so many expenses. We need everyone to help each other. We need to be united to face these effects of climate change." So, Sylvia, climate change. Now, because Venice has had a flooding problem for a long time, more than many decades. Is this, are we hearing now Italian officials pointing to the inexorable effect of climate change as a major part of the problem?
Well, it's very interesting to hear that Brugnaro said that, because he's also a member of, he comes from a center-right party that has never really been very much in acknowledging the dangers of climate change. So it's interesting that he has changed his mind. You know, this is something that is more mystifying than anything, is that the Venetians, that the Italians never went to, it seems they never went to Holland to see what the Dutch have been doing, and they've certainly been working to help protect, their country from tidal waves. There's been this insane huge big project called MOSE, which stands for an acronym, but the word means Moses in Italian, and the sense of the parting of the waters. It's perhaps the biggest civil engineering project that's ever been undertaken in Italy, and it's been under construction for 16 years, and it's still unfinished, and it's been plagued by cost overruns, big delays, and many, many corruption scandals. In fact, most Venetians believe that this project was the most expensive, and it was picked on purpose simply for that, so that as many people as possible could shave off as much money as they could.
I mean, we're talking in the, 10 to 20 billion euro range here. We'll talk a lot more about MOSE a little later in this hour, Sylvia, because that being the chosen solution for the double problem of climate change and a sinking city is a very interesting test case. But Sylvia Poggioli joining us from Rome. Hang on, Sylvia, because I want to turn now to Venice itself. And joining us is Toto Bergamo Rossi. He's director of the Venetian Heritage Foundation, which restores buildings and artworks in Venice. He's author of Inside Venice, A Private View of the City's Most Beautiful Interiors. Toto Bergamo Rossi, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So, from your perspective there in Venice, as a master restorer, how bad is the damage from this latest flooding right now?
Well, as Sylvia mentioned before, I mean, you have to understand especially from American people, it's not a Katrina, it's not a tornado, it's not a big river with a lot of currents that took the house down. It's not this. It's the level of the water that raised, and the problem is the water is salty. So the salt goes inside every single brick, wall, wooden beams, and the salt transmits the humidity up. So it's a kind of cancer that even if you wash a lot and you clean and wash with the clean water, but once that materials are touched by the salty water, they started to have that kind of deterioration project that take forever and ever. So this is the real thing that people doesn't get. So it's a seawater that go inside every single building and transmit after, when the water is done, is over, when the flood is over, you have that kind of salt crystal in every brick, and after the brick started to explode, it's something very slow, but it's a kind of long reaction that make things disappear.
Right. Well, and in fact, when floodwaters subside in Venice, you can see the evidence of that sort of that capillary action, that leaching of the salt up further from
exactly.
the foundations. You can visually see it. And as you say, it has this long-term corrosive effect on the buildings, mm-hmm. on the frescoes, on the walls. Can you tell us specifically, Sylvia had mentioned St. Mark's Basilica. Now, Piazza San Marco is one of the lowest points in Venice here. What is happening specifically to this beautiful historic church in Venice?
Well, because, you know, this is the old part of Venice, and this is why St. Mark's Basilica still looks like a Byzantine temple, because it was never renovated and never really changed style during the century. So it's still an early Middle Age building, and the level of the floor still the original one. So this is why that part of the city is very low, because, I mean, the rest of Venice was, you know, renovated many times during many centuries. So they raised the level of a little street, of some other squares, but San Marco squares, and especially the Basilica, still at a level of, you know, 10th century. So this is why, and with the raise of the water everywhere in general compared to 10 centuries ago, of course, the water now goes almost every day close to the Basilica of St. Mark, and especially this time was a huge amount of water in.
And Sylvia had mentioned that there's flooding in the crypt of San Marco?
Yeah. This is what's very bad, because they have done this work like a few years ago. The crypt is under the main altar. And by the way, we call crypt, but it was the original old church is the crypt of St. Mark. And after they built the big one on top, so it's a very old part of the building. And it was completely isolated a few years ago to avoid water problem. The water was coming from the floor. In this case, it was not coming from the floor, but from the floor above. So it was like a waterfall. And the water gets stuck in. And, you know, it's something like, I mean, nobody thought about it. The water would come from the floor because there it's quite high.
So Toto Bergamo Rossi, stand by for just a moment. And Silvia Poggioli in Rome, hang on. We will be right back. We are talking about the historic high water in Venice and how climate change and engineering solutions all factor into a test case for every city on planet Earth that's on the water. We'll be back in just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about historic flooding in Venice, about climate change, and about saving one of the world's most beloved cities. I'm joined today by Sylvia Poggioli. She's with us from Rome. She's senior European correspondent for NPR. Toto Bergamo-Rossi also joins us. He's in Venice. He's director of the Venetian Heritage Foundation, which restores buildings and artworks in Venice. And Mr. Bergamo-Rossi, let me ask you, you were talking about how there had been some efforts in years past to sort of isolate parts of St. Mark's Basilica from water, to keep the water out. But of course, water finds a way, especially as it rises and rises. I just wonder, are there efforts or thinking underway that perhaps regarding San Marco specifically, do parts of it need to be moved? I mean, can this building be saved in the long run?
Well, you know, the problem is you can't take San Marco Basilica and put in some other places. I mean, it would never happen. And you cannot raise the level of the floor because all the architectural design will change, and so it's not really possible. I think we have to continue to work in this way, but just, you know, we have to make that project finish. I mean, the very, very, you know, everybody talk about this mosaic, this mm-hmm. water gate, the barrier, and as Silvia said before, I mean, it's 90% of the works has been done in too many years, and a lot of money disappeared, and it was very contradicted between different political parts. But in any case, we have to be pragmatic, and the word pragmatic is not something that we use a lot in my country, unfortunately. So we have to be pragmatic and just finish that, because they spent already seven billions of euro on the project. And there is like a plan to finish everything in a year, year and a half. So I hope that now, with that kind of big catastrophe that we had last week, they could accelerate and end this project earlier, right, just to prevent any other, you know, we can't have another flood like this. And I was born in 1967, so the big floods of 1966, you know, when I grew up, I always heard about the floods of 66 and the effect and the damage and how bad it was. But I mean, it's unbelievable that after 53 years, we're still with the same problem.
Well, Silvia, let me turn back to you here, because Toto mentioned that perhaps this latest historic flooding might kick in a sense of pragmatism to get those dams fixed. I mean, based on folks that you've spoken to in the past week or so, is that sense of urgency now amongst the Italian political bureaucracy?
Well, you know, the project, they've just, as Toto just said, that their plan, they have said that they will have it completed by the end of 2021. That's, you know, that's 2 years from now, which is, you know, a long time. The other question people are raising, it was projected, the design was done something like at the end of the 90s, early 2000s. And it's not clear whether they did at that time, you know, I don't know what the predictions were of rising sea levels at the time. Many people are worried that it's not going to be, they're not going to be sufficient to really keep the tides away. The other issue is the environmentalists are very worried that even once it's functioning, that the floodgates will have to be open a lot of the time, which means that the lagoon gets cut off from the ocean, from the sea. And that would alter the whole, you know, the whole ecosystem that has been really built and been nurtured by human beings for you know, 1500 years. It's a marvel of this combination of human and nature working together, the Venetian lagoon, which is a huge lagoon, and it's a very delicate ecosystem. And there's this concern that even once, if they do function, which nobody is really sure that they will, I'm sorry about my skepticism, but I think I'm reflecting the sense of most Venetians. I heard only skepticism. I didn't hear much enthusiasm on the part of anybody. They're so tired and resentful towards also politicians and what they've been hearing for so long. So it's not clear that even once, if they do work, you know, what impact it will have on the lagoon, on the ecosystem. There's a big unknown there.
Well, Toto Bergamo-Rossi, one last question for you. I mean, as a Venetian, you know better than any of us around the rest of the world that I mean, one of the painful ironies here is that Venice is water. Water is Venice. This is a city that, since its founding on those many, many millions of piles that all those buildings sit on, has been intricately bound to water. And yet here it is water that is spelling the overall, perhaps the overall doom for Venice. I mean, do you think that, let me just ask you, can Venice be saved in the long run?
Well, if we continue like this, I don't think so. Also because, I mean, that sometimes big catastrophe can provoke something at the end, something good, I mean, reaction. So my concern is not about only about the big floods that we had a few days ago, but it's the way that the city is run. And not only under the last administration of our little local Donald Trump than we have as a mayor of Venice, but that is not only about that. It's more about years. I mean, it's years of neglected position. I mean, the people, they don't decide. Venice still run like in 1970 when we have at the time maximum 6 or 7 million by year of tourists. This year we have 30 million presence, and we still have the same kind of organization. So it's not, you know, if they don't take serious, important from the government in Rome decision about how Venice should be run, it's going to be like a dead city, a Disney World, just for cheap tourists, and of course with water everywhere. And this is something like make me really suffer so much, because, you know, I dedicated my life to try to save the most beautiful building of the city, the museum, the churches, the collection, make exhibition, make books, scholarship. And the result is that at the end, everybody wants to use Venice, almost everybody, just to make their own little money. And there is no big vision about what is going to be Venice in 20 years.
Right. If there's a Venice in 20 years.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Well, Toto Bergamo Rossi, director of the Venetian Heritage Foundation, which restores and preserves artworks in Venice, joining us from Venice, Italy today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's dig in a lot deeper into what we've talked about already this hour, and that is that question of flood water protection and this massive engineering project that is hoping to be the savior of the city of Venice. So joining us now for more on that is Rafael Bras. He's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. He's professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering and at the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech. He also worked on the flood barrier project in Venice from 1995 to 2013, working with the consortium that's developing the flood barrier project. He headed a group of experts overseeing the barrier's development. Professor Bras, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So first of all, I'd like to actually just sort of give people a much more detailed sense as to what we're talking about when we're talking about these submersible flood barriers, right? So take us to those three inlets on the edge of the Venetian Lagoon where the water from the Adriatic Sea flushes in and out every day. Those are the sites where these Mose dams are being built. Is that right?
That is correct. The idea is to protect the lagoon of Venice in general, not just Venice, although that's certainly the main subject. It's a 50 kilometer long lagoon, but it has three well-defined inlets. If you can separate those, the sea from the lagoon during periods of flooding, then we would have protection of the lagoon.
And the design of the Mose barriers themselves, right? They're designed to sit underwater flat, right, during regular tidal events, so that the water can come in and out of the lagoon. And then when a high tide or a particularly high tide is predicted, those barriers are supposed to rise up and close off the lagoon. Is that right?
That is correct. They were designed to effectively sit underwater and go into operation only when needed. And the reason for that is to allow traffic in and out of the inlets. And also for aesthetic reasons, I think that there was a requirement originally for designs that would be as less intrusive as possible.
Mm. And flood barriers like this are, we've seen in other places. I mean, the Thames Barrier in London is a good example. It stays open most of the time, so the Thames River can flow into the North Sea, but it can close to protect London with unusually high tide events there. So it's not an out of the ordinary idea here. But why has it taken so long to to construct the Mosaic Barrier? You heard Sylvia, you know, report that it's not done yet. It might be done in 2 years, but it's been a long time. What's the holdup?
Well, that's unfortunate, and I'm not sure I know all the answers, but as you know, the barrier was originally intended to take on the order between 8 and 10 years to build. If I recall correctly, our target date at that point was something like 2012. Delays had occurred largely because of financing issues. Since then, there were corruption issues that arose, so political corruption, corruption in the unit that was doing it. That led to all sort of actions. So, but unfortunately, those actions seem to have implied that the stopping of the effort to finish the barriers were largely finished by the end of 2013.
Mm. Sylvia, do you have a thought on that? I mean, does it seem still kind of optimistic that the Italians might finish this project on the timeline they've stated?
Well, it is an Italian problem generally. It's not just in Venice that delays, and again, usually mostly due to corruption and not more than anything else. But no, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, they say another 2 years. That I think that brings it to 18 years if it is completed by the end, and who knows how much more money. It's true, there's also in Italy, when there's changes of political governments, instead of having sort of a continuity, when one government makes a certain decision, the next government comes in and starts blocking it, making complications, money is suspended. So there's that. It's certainly that is also one reason for delay. But there's also tremendous suspicion of where all this money has gone and why it is the sums have increased, the cost have increased so much over this period. We'll see.
Vediamo, right?
Yeah. But, you know, yesterday I visited the island of Pelestrina, which is one of the barrier islands. There's Lido, and the three inlets are at the top of Lido, at the bottom of Lido, and then there's Pelestrina, then Chioggia on the mainland. And there's these very thin strips of barrier islands, Lido and Pelestrina. And Pelestrina last week suffered tremendous damage. It's mainly, its inhabitants are mostly fishermen. And I went to the along the port there, and it's just like a row of electrical appliances, refrigerators, washing machines, absolutely destroyed by the waters. They all were all the homes were flooded. The fishermen have this unique thing that they have in the Venice Lagoon. They have these. You see, when you go in by boat, you'll see often these wooden platforms that you're never really sure that you're like little sheds. And what they are, they're storage areas for fishermen where they keep their nets and their equipments and tools. And several fishermen told me theirs were totally destroyed. One was like 200 square meters, a shed. He lost everything. All the fishermen have lost all their nets, everything. Because the combination also, what happened last week was the combination of an extremely high tide plus a very, very strong wind, two winds, the northern Bora wind coming from the north and the Scirocco coming from the south. It was literally everybody calls it. It was a perfect storm.
Wow. Well, Professor Bras, let's acknowledge that the very existence of Venice shows repeatedly the triumph of human engineering, right? I mean, this is a city that was first, when it was built on the water using many millions of wooden piles and kind of an act of audacity, I would say, 1,000 years ago that the Venetians said, we can do this, and they did it. And then we've had subsequent, you know, in the centuries following, other large-scale engineering projects to help save Venice. Sylvia had mentioned earlier that rivers have been diverted out of the lagoon so that those rivers don't pour, all sorts of contaminants and chemicals into the lagoon. So the idea that engineering can save Venice is deeply embedded into this city's history. I want to acknowledge that. But given the multiple factors right now, most specifically climate change, that are acting on Venice here, do you still think a flood barrier solution is the right one?
I believe it is. I think the flood barrier will, in fact, work for a significant amount of time. We have to acknowledge that if sea level rise continues, and this is not just strictly limited to the Adriatic, it will be a concern all across the world. So if Venice were able to protect the lagoon, and as Sylvia pointed out, it's not just Venice, appropriately for several decades of considerable length, there's time to think of solutions. But at that point, if the worst happens, let's face it, Manhattan, South Florida, New Orleans, we got problems all over the world to deal with that condition.
There's no doubt about that. And that's why this is so vitally important. The question then becomes, is 10 billion euros for a system of flood barriers that might buy Venice a couple of decades, is that the best and smartest use of those 10 billion euros to achieve the longest term protection for the city? Every coastal city you just mentioned has to do that same cost-benefit analysis. Are there other ways to spend 10 billion euros to protect Venice for a longer period of time?
In my opinion, I don't have any other solution that will guarantee saving Venice forever, if that's what you're implying. This is a solution that would work, and as you stated earlier, in fact, barriers are used across the world quite successfully. So I think this will do it, and it will have to be done in other places. And the amount of money is a lot, but it's not unreasonable.
Well, Professor Rafael Bras and Sylvia Poggioli, stand by. We are talking about saving Venice in the face of climate change. We'll dig into more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about historic flooding in Venice, Italy, and what it's going to take to save this city, and lessons for coastal cities around the world as climate change keeps sea levels rising inexorably. And we're joined today by Rafael Bras. He's professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Georgia Tech. He also worked on the consortium developing Venice's flood barrier project. He worked on that consortium from 1995 to 2013. He's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. And joining us from Rome is Sylvia Poggioli. She is senior European correspondent for NPR, and she just spent quite a bit of time in flood-sodden Venice here. And Sylvia, in the course of your reporting, you talked to a lot of people about their current take and reactions to this Mose barrier project that we've been discussing. Tell us more about what people have told you.
Well, as I said, there's a tremendous amount of skepticism. There's anger. There's frustration. But everybody says, okay, right already. Let's get it completed. Let's let it, you know, let's see what it can do. I think the other thing that certainly a lot of people I spoke to also said that given this, given also the attention, worldwide attention that this has drawn, Venice, the visual impact of seeing people walking, wading in water up to their knees and St. Mark's Square flooded. Why doesn't Venice become, in a sense, it would be the perfect city to become a sort of international laboratory to study climate change in every sense, not just scientific, not just the technological aspect, but kind of like, you know, it's the environmental issue. They're talking about it as environmental humanities, also from the cultural point of view, from the human aspect of what it means to live with rising sea level. Venice, with all its universities, with all its foundations, it's sort of like the perfect place to really, you know, for the rest of the world, it would be the perfect place to sort of start thinking about this major problem, which is already affecting so many coastal areas all over the world.
Right. It was real time, as you're saying, to sort of think about the human effects and impacts of climate change happening, as you say, in Venice. Professor Bras, I want to sort of look at the different factors at play here in more detail. We're talking about historic floods right now in Venice, but I'm seeing here that just St. Mark's Square, Piazza San Marco, just regularly floods more than 60 times a year anyway in sort of normal flood events. And given the fact that the Adriatic continues to rise, and not just the Adriatic, we have mean sea level rising all over planet Earth here. But as it continues to rise, aren't we facing a future, I don't know, 50 years from now, where those, the Mose barriers might have to be continuously closed?
That's certainly a possibility, and that was considered during the design of the barrier. And elements of appropriate different management to ameliorate a condition where the sea level rise went over that design were studied. And as I said, no engineering solution like the barriers or anything else is permanent. That you have a horizon and you try to resolve it. But the bottom line in my mind is that we got a real problem. The world has a real problem. More importantly, the Italians and Venetians have a real problem. And it has to be dealt now with the way we can. As Sylvia pointed out, there was plenty of skepticism about the Mose project. And I understand that. There was a lot of debate back and forth before anything was done. A lot of it driven by political arguments one way or another. I believe that the time is now. Something needs to be done. The sense of urgency is now. But I must say, back in 1966, we had the same sense of urgency. That's what led to ultimately international competitions and discussions and ultimately to the design of this project. I just hope that we'll see the project completed. We're losing time. It is nearly there. It could have been done. This is the time, as Sylvia pointed out.
But let me ask you, these specifically to Venice and its lagoon, if you have those barriers having to be closed repeatedly or far more often because mean sea level is going up, where the lagoon is, it's the lungs, it's the environmental lungs of that whole region. And part of we haven't talked enough about this, part of the profound environmental concern is that you have chemical-laden runoff coming from the Italian mainland pouring into the lagoon of Venice. That has to get flushed out into the sea. So one of the potential negative environmental consequences here is if those barriers are closed often or permanently, could it not choke the lagoon itself?
Let me put it this way. If sea level rises to the worst scenarios, then what is the option? You have a choice. Second, I would argue, and let's think of this, you said it very well, if you want to eliminate water contamination, then don't put the contaminants in the water.
Yeah.
And that is clearly the first order of the solution. And a lot of that has been done. I think that given a situation of inexorably rising sea level, the choice is, do you protect the city or not? One way or another, if it gets to that point, we have to separate the Adriatic from the lagoon. Otherwise, you give up the city. So that is the key. And as you said earlier, the lagoon of Venice, and Venice is an engineered environment. The Venetians were unbelievable engineers, for better or worse. They created a lagoon where there was none. It was, at this point in time, without Venetian interventions, that would be a whole marshland. The diversion of the rivers were not an issue of contamination, were an issue of eliminating sediments into the lagoon so that the lagoon will not fill up. Mm. In fact, the problem now is that you don't want to redirect the rivers because then they will bring contaminants into the lagoon. So we have to think that this is an engineer environment, for better or worse, an engineer environment that we all love and we need to protect. And I think that there are engineer solutions, but that's not going to be all. There are socioeconomic issues, as right. has been discussed, to make the city come alive again. But it cannot come alive underwater.
Sylvia, in your reporting on Venice, I've heard the professor say a couple times already that the Mosè project is sort of the centerpiece of a system of ideas to save Venice. It's very expensive, though, and it's taken a long time. Did you speak with other people who said, no, there are other solutions that Venice can adopt that might actually be more effective?
Well, I haven't heard, you know, people are just, no. I mean, there were at the beginning other solutions. I don't know all the technical details of what they were, but certainly at least the vox populi is that this was the most expensive, and clearly they chose that one so that some sort of a lot of people can make as much money as they can. That's sort of what the average Venetian believes, and it's pretty widespread.
Hmm. Well, Rafael Bras, there's another issue that we actually haven't discussed at all about why Venice has this accelerating problem. The sea level is rising, for sure, but the city itself is sinking, right? I mean, there's subsidence going on all across Venice that's also human-caused?
Yes and no. Subsidence is indeed an issue, and it was a very serious issue until the late 60s, early 70s, when it was determined that a lot of the subsidence was the result of water pumping for industrial uses in the area of Mestre, which is in the mainland. A lot of those uses and water pumping was eliminated, and the rate of subsidence then reduced. So the rate of subsidence that we have measured, at least the last time I saw the data, is what I would call the natural rate of subsidence, the consolidation of the clays under the lagoon and the lagoon area that has been going forever and will go forever. At this point, that rate is probably no less than a fourth or a fifth of the sea level rise. So the number one issue is sea level rise.
Okay. So let me ask you, Sylvia said something earlier in the program which I thought was very, very important. And that is, you know, if we're looking at Venice as a canary in the coal mine, we also, on the flip side, we have entire nations, specifically in the Netherlands, that have been dealing with holding back water for centuries here. So, I mean, what lessons can we draw from the Netherlands? It's not just like one giant engineering project that the Dutch have done. They have a whole system at various levels of flood control. Could something like that be adopted? I mean, what would you look to in the Netherlands as relevant to Venice?
Well, I think the Dutch have been extraordinarily good at doing this, and they're certainly the leaders. But keep in mind that the Dutch are not talking of saving a lagoon. They're talking about saving their country. That's the magnitude of the issue they face. And they have dealt with it quite aggressively without much political discussion because it's life or death for them. And they have done it with a multiple of things, from barriers along the coast to tidal barriers like in the port of Rotterdam, which works on the exactly the same concept or principle that we have in Venice, is separating, in this case, the North Sea from the port of Rotterdam. So, again, they're doing it. They do have a much bigger problem, and they have invested hundreds of times more, if not more, because their country depends on it.
Mm. Well, but could we take some lessons from the Dutch in terms of the efficacy of more local level flood control? I mean, I know because of Venice's historic nature and the importance of its architecture, particularly, has there been resistance to the idea of like maybe just. I'll take Piazza San Marco as an example. Maybe we ought to be erecting more local flood barriers right there to keep the water out.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Meghna, because in fact, the people think of the so-called MOSE project as the barriers. In reality, it was more than that. And that is something that disappoints me that they haven't carried through. The project itself had the protection, separation of the Adriatic from the lagoon from via the barriers. But that kicks in when the floods are predicted above a certain level. Below that level, for example, in Piazza San Marco, the local protection was supposed to be operating. And that involves making the whole, and there's plans for that, there are designs for that, the Piazza San Marco in essence, preventing water from going up from below, which happens very early on with natural tides, and raising the walls along the edge of the Grand Canal there. So other parts of Venice, there were plans of raising the pavements, and they were raised in different places where it could be done without affecting architectonically important areas. So the bottom line is you're absolutely correct. This was not just simply raising barriers or building barriers. It was a combination of local protection for the smaller floods and the barriers only for the high floods. And people forget that.
Mm. But of course, the long-term problem is that those high floods will become far more frequent because of sea level rise and climate change. Is that not true, Professor Bruss?
That is absolutely true. And in fact, it was evident 15 years ago. The data was there that was indeed happening. We're just seeing what we've been seeing now for the last years. Mm.
Sylvia, we've just got about 2 minutes left here, and I want to return this back to the people of Venice itself. I mean, we know that cruise ships disgorge millions of tourists into the city every year here, which is kind of a strange irony because Venice has been slowly depopulating over time in terms of its livability as an actual city where people live and raise their families here. How are Venetians looking upon sort of this precipice that their city is at?
You mean the vanishing Venetians?
The vanishing Venetians, that's right.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, because, okay, what's left, because I think it's something like a little over 50,000, about, a tremendous, they're just losing people all the time. Students can't afford to live there. It's just extreme. There are no more any grocery stores, hardly any grocery stores. It's just even moving things, as you can imagine, because all the bridges and everything, just any kind of transportation of goods is, everything's very expensive in Venice. There are no more plumbers. There are more carpenters. There's a lot of tourist souvenir shops, designer boutiques. it's a city that has really become a catering mainly to tourists. Big spenders, and the probably the most damaging are the day trippers. They're just, because they don't spend that much, they come and they leave a lot of waste, and there's a lot of complaints about, there's talk about putting taxes on, in entries, taxes to people coming in. So it's a huge problem. And so, you know, something needs to be done. It's very hopeful that a tragedy like this, a disaster like this flood, the last week of huge high, exceptional high tides, may finally sort of, you know, stimulate people into thinking that something has to be done to help also the Venetians to make it a living city again. It's going to be very hard, though, because, you know, there's not much political or vision right now in this country.
Well, Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent for NPR, speaking to us from Rome. Silvia, it's a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Raphael Bras, professor in the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering and at the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech. He worked for the consortium developing Venice's flood barrier project between 1995 and 2013. Professor Bras, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.